Hi, I'm Steve Engelberg, editor-in-chief of ProPublica. Welcome to the podcast. When New York Fed examiner Carmen Segura uncovered problems with Goldman Sachs' conflict of interest policy, the implications for the financial giant were serious. Segura says she was pressured to change her findings by her superiors. When she refused, she was fired. She's now filed a wrongful termination suit seeking reinstatement and damages. Our reporter, Jake Bernstein, spent many hours with Ms. Segura examining her story and documents. He joins us today. In the past week, you've introduced the world to someone that probably no one really heard of before, Carmen Segura, former bank examiner at the Federal Reserve. Tell us a little bit about who she is and what her job was and why what she says is so important.
Sure. Carmen Segura is a lawyer with an Ivy League pedigree who has built a career for herself in the area of compliance issues at banks, primarily investment banks. And what that means is she sort of helps the banks devise policies and procedures so that they're compliant with government regulations. Like, for example, she'll help a bank with their anti-money laundering procedures so that they're up to code and they're doing all the things that the government requires them to do. In 2011, she got a job with the Federal Reserve, where she would be a senior bank examiner. The Fed was ramping up their examiners to try to get up to speed with financial reform measures that were passed in 2010 because they have more responsibility under those measures to regulate the financial system.
And let me interrupt there for a second. So, you know, there's a lot of different kinds of banks and there's a lot of banking regulators out there, but she was sent out to look at a particular kind of bank, wasn't she?
Yes. The financial reform has given the Federal Reserve particular responsibility over these so-called too-big-to-fail banks. In bureaucratic parlance, they are systemically important financial institutions, or SIFIs. And the Fed is really supposed to pay attention to these very complex, very large financial institutions. And so she was hired as part of this wave of the Fed staffing up to send people into these SIFIs. And the SIFI that she was assigned to was Goldman Sachs.
A particularly large financial institution. And her job was to figure out whether or not they had a firm-wide policy on conflicts of interest. Now, that sounds like a kind of technical thing, right? It sounds like, you know, do you have enough paper clips? But it's not that at all, is it? Why is that important?
In 2008, the Fed told banks that they needed these firm-wide policies, including conflicts of interest policies, all kinds of compliance policies. And the idea was that the Fed was looking at these huge, complex organizations, these banks and other financial institutions, and they were thinking, you know, there's a good possibility that one department in this giant financial organization doesn't know what the other department is doing. So what we need is some kind of umbrella policy where it covers everybody. And particularly, we need conflicts of interest policies that are like that are firm-wide so that one department isn't doing something that would run afoul of what another department was doing and cause all kinds of conflicts. And so that was the thinking behind these firm-wide policies.
So Ms. Segura starts her job. She's a brand new employee. She starts reading up and studying the policies in place at Goldman Sachs. What does she find?
Well, she finds that there are major issues with Goldman Sachs policies on conflicts of interest, and she finds that she's not really seeing a firm-wide policy and that the policies and procedures that they do have serious holes in them.
Well, one thing that I found fascinating in your story, I mean, this is obviously a very legalistic part of the business that they're in. So was a lawyer at Goldman Sachs in charge of all this?
No, actually. As a matter of fact, Goldman Sachs had this organization that was supposed to deal with the firm-wide conflicts of interest problems, and the organization was called Business Selection and Conflict Resolution. So this kind of stunned regulators that these two things would be together, business selection and conflicts resolution, because at least to Segura's mind, these are very separate things, right? Business selection is the kind of business we do, you know, how we can make money. Conflicts resolution is the business that we can't do, what we're supposed to turn away. So the person who was heading this had been the head of conflicts issues at Goldman since at least 1992, and she was not a lawyer at all.
So, Jake, this is a conflict about a very specific thing, conflict of interest policy, Goldman Sachs. But does it have larger implications? Why should ordinary listeners and readers care about a dispute between this new team of Fed advisors and the Fed itself? What's the larger significance of this?
It absolutely does have significance because, remarkably enough, since the financial crisis, these huge financial institutions like Goldman Sachs have grown even bigger, have become even more complex, and even more dangerous if something bad happens to them. And at the same time, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York has been given even more responsibility to ensure that that doesn't happen, to safeguard the financial system and oversee it to make sure that it's safe and sound. This idea that the Fed is not on top of issues that could actually lead to these financial institutions weakening or becoming problems is a big deal and should worry everybody because we all remember what happened with the financial crisis and what an impact that had. So Congress gave the Fed more responsibility to supervise these banks, and this calls into question how well they're doing that.
Now, Goldman obviously gets in the news from time to time. They're awfully big and people cover them. Have there been previous cases of conflicts of interest that people found notable?
Yeah, absolutely. Goldman has a reputation on Wall Street for running afoul of conflicts of interest problems. And there's been all kinds of issues, and they've been chastised by regulators. There's been lawsuits. This is a perennial and reoccurring problem for Goldman Sachs.
Now, Sagara, as she dug into all of this, I think started to look at some case studies. She went beyond just sort of, do you have a document or not? And I gather that she found some things that were troubling.
Well, this is the thing that her bosses told her to pay particular interest to conflicts of interest and also to pay particular interest to a couple of deals that Goldman was involved in at the time that were already generating headlines for issues with conflicts. And one particular deal that she spent most of her time involved the merger of these two giant energy companies, El Paso and Kinder Morgan.
So which side did Goldman Sachs represent in that merger?
Goldman Sachs represented both sides, and they were an advisor to El Paso, a longtime advisor, actually. And then Kinder Morgan, the company that was trying to acquire El Paso, Goldman actually had a $4 billion stake in that company.
Well, that seems complicated for Goldman. How did they actually try to sort out preventing one part of the company from using its knowledge to change the price of the other part of the deal?
Well, Goldman said that what it did was something that's very typical on Wall Street in these kinds of circumstances, which is they built what's called a Chinese wall, which was it's an effort to separate the two teams of bankers that are working for each company. So the idea is that these two teams, the bankers who are working with El Paso and the bankers that are working with Kinder Morgan, will have no contact with each other. There will be no communication. So it'll essentially be like two banks.
Like a blue team and a red team.
That's exactly what they called it, as a matter of fact. And so the idea was, here we have our El Paso bankers, here we have our Kinder Morgan bankers. And Sagara began to look into this and really dig. And she found some things that hadn't been publicized in the media and that El Paso probably didn't know about.
Well, it sounds like a good arrangement. You just tell people to behave themselves. And, you know, it's like a juror being sequestered, right? I mean, you're not supposed to discuss the case outside the jury room. So why wasn't the Chinese wall an effective way of dividing the interests here?
Well, she found that three of the bankers on the El Paso team had previously held important positions working on behalf of Kinder Morgan at Goldman Sachs. So even if you had built a wall after creating these teams, they couldn't forget what they already knew. They were perfectly positioned to understand what Kinder Morgan wanted and to presumably push El Paso in that direction. She also found that the lead banker on the El Paso team had an investment in Kinder Morgan, a personal investment of $340,000. Now, that came out in the media, and remarkably enough, that's how Sagara and the other regulators found out about it, not from Goldman Sachs, who they were constantly questioning about this deal and asking for documents about, but when it showed up in a lawsuit, a shareholder lawsuit.
So it sounds like in a matter of months, Carmen Sagara comes to the conclusion that Goldman's policies are not adequate. So what does she do then? What's the next step? She's obviously not empowered to by herself do anything. So what does she do as part of a team?
Well, there's a whole process here. So they've hired, they're called legal and compliance risk specialists. Sagara is one. She's assigned to Goldman Sachs. But there are nine others who are assigned to other too-big-to-fail banks. And they meet weekly. And so they have this long meeting where everyone presents the findings that they've derived from their examinations of their respective banks, and they all agree on what are the next steps. And the next steps for Goldman Sachs and Sagara was there was probably going to be an enforcement action of some sort. They were going to tell Goldman Sachs that they had to fix things, and they were going to downgrade the rating in this little piece, which was policies and procedures. And according to Sagara and another examiner interviewed, there was general agreement that that was the next step.
So what does that mean in practical terms? I mean, these bank examinations are pretty much secret. I mean, does it cost Goldman money? Does it cost them prestige? What does it ultimately mean to them?
Well, the potential impact, if Sagara's findings had led to its inevitable conclusion, probably would have been that Goldman would have had to have taken conflicts of interest more seriously and changed some of their business practices. Now, Goldman says today that they have reviewed these policies and that everything is perfectly fine. We don't have a Carmen Sagara inside Goldman who can tell us whether, in fact, that is the case.
All right. So she proposes this to the group. The group kind of agrees, but it doesn't happen. How does this thing get stopped?
This is very interesting and sort of points to some issues that the Fed probably needs to work out. Sagara reports up to a Fed official who is the head of her legal and compliance team. But there's also a Fed official who is stationed at the bank. He is the senior supervising officer, and he is actually in the hierarchy above Carmen's immediate boss. So she brings these findings to him, and initially he doesn't object to them, but then he starts to have issues with them. And he sends her an email saying, I actually think that they do have this firm-wide policy. And before she can respond, she's dragged into a more than 30-minute meeting with him and his deputy where they try to convince her that she's wrong and that she should change her policy. When she refuses to do that, she after the meeting, she sends him an email saying, I can't do that. I simply have too much evidence pointing to the contrary. Three business days after her email, she's fired.
Wow, that's a pretty stiff response. Now, you're describing all these things in great detail, and obviously we know that Carmen Sagara is suing, so she has a viewpoint on these events. So how do we know that what you're saying is the full account of this? What's our evidence beyond her word?
Well, one of the things we have is extensive documentation. Sagara has provided documentation. She appended it to her complaint that she filed in this lawsuit, which sort of details her meeting minutes and notes and some of the documents that she got from Goldman Sachs that sort of buttress the story that she's telling. And then we have also done interviews with people that give credence to what Sagara said.
Jake, you're one of the only journalists who have interviewed Carmen Sagara. In your conversations with her, how does she come across?
She comes across as very credible and very dedicated. I think she really saw the Fed as an opportunity to both to have stability professionally, it's a job that is very well regarded, but also as an opportunity to sort of help stabilize the financial system after the financial crisis. As so often is the case, she's a bit of a do-gooder, but she's also very dedicated and a big believer in the importance of these kinds of compliance policies. You know, that there's a right way to do things and there's a wrong way to do things. And she was sort of horrified when she found out that that wasn't really the way it seemed to be working at the Fed and Goldman.
Now, we've interviewed some of the figures in this, or at least attempted to. We've attempted to reach people for comment. What does the Fed say about all this? What does Goldman say about all that?
Well, Goldman again says that they did a review of their conflicts, policies, and procedures starting in 2011, and that they feel very confident that they are compliant in every way. They will not comment on Sagara's particular story because they say it's an issue for the Fed, not for Goldman. As far as the Fed's concerned, they are also unwilling to comment, although they have released some filings already, a letter in the court document where they basically characterize Sagara as a gold digger who's just looking for the money, and also as a criminal for having, in their words, purloined confidential supervisory information.
Well, I gather, in fact, the Fed attempted to put a gag order on this case where there's been a complaint file and a number of documents put in the public record. How did that work out?
That did not work out well for the Fed. The judge basically said, this information is public. Pick your metaphor, the genie's out of the bottle, the cat's out of the bag. And so there's really no point in putting all this stuff under seal.
Well, Jake, I assume you're going to be following this story in the coming weeks and months. What don't we know yet? What do we need to find out more about?
Well, I think there's probably more to Segarra's story that we'll find out. I mean, there's one of the big sort of unanswered questions is, was the decision to fire her and the decision to push back on what she was finding about Goldman Sachs, did that stop at the senior supervising officer at Goldman for the Fed, or does it go higher? Was there someone else at the Fed at a higher level who told them that this wasn't working out, that we need to stop this examiner for some reason?
Well, I look forward to reading that story. Jake Bernstein, thanks very much. Fascinating work.
Thanks, Steve.
That was Jake Bernstein, ProPublica reporter. For more on the story, go to our site, ProPublica.org. I'm Steve Engelberg. Catch you later.